Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Chrysanthi Giodis. In this edition, like everyone else, we are preparing for the dark days of the coronavirus crisis and searching for a way through. Overnight, we saw the upward curve continue to spike. Social distancing measures are going to take a while to take effect, as well as other measures. And so we ask, how can you inoculate yourself against the fake news and unnecessary punditry, especially given the sheer volume of information sweeping through the community? And while we're at it, how do we look after our own mental health and find new news practices to support our families and communities? To navigate our way through these questions, we are joined by an expert panel second to none. Mark Pearson is Professor of Journalism and Social Media at the Griffith Centre for Social and Cultural Research, Griffith University. He has been section editor for The Australian and has freelanced for the Sydney Morning Herald, Crikey, The Wall Street Journal, among many others. Mark, thanks for joining us from Queensland.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Dr. Anne Kruger is Bureau Editor Australia for First Draft News. She has worked for Bloomberg and the ABC, again among others. And full transparency, she's currently my boss as the Acting Co-Director at the Centre for Media Transition at UTS. Anne, welcome and thanks for also joining us from Queensland.
Thank you. My pleasure. And you're very easy to be a boss for.
Thank you. I'll pay you later. Hugh Remington is a Walkley Award-winning journalist and is the National Affairs Editor at 10 News First. He has been foreign correspondent, co-anchored Eyewitness News on Channel 10 with Sandra Sully. He has also presented Nightline on Channel 10 and worked for CNN. He has also been on the front line of this virus with a scare in his own home. Hugh Remington, also joining us virtually. Great to have you on the show.
Nice to be with you.
Okay, so as you can tell, this is an entirely virtual show. We are all in uncharted territory at the moment. But let's start on a positive note. How has the media performed? And for you guys, what has been the high points? Hugh, can I ask you to go first?
Look, I think it's very hard to really judge how the media has performed. I think what we've got to understand is that the media is many things. And then it also perceives its jobs in different ways. So in a time of crisis, the media's main job is to provide, fundamentally as it is at any other time, reliable information. But the stakes are that much higher. So the job there is in part to make sure that the official information is coming from prime ministers, health ministers, premiers, chief medical officers, and getting that out to the public in a respectful way so that their message is not overly diluted or distorted in that process, even though there will be alternative views which will have their own legitimacy to whatever the official position is. So that is a proper healthy debate. There is obviously a social media world, and there is on the fringe non-social media, but also things like talkback radio and other sorts of things, which are also players in this, and they will take their own position on it. So you'd have to say the media overall would be a bare pass mark, taken as a whole, but as a bulwark against some of the crazier notions that are out there, it has been strong. Having said that, social media has also been strong if you know where to look and how to filter out the information at the moment.
Right, so it's navigating that debate, and at the moment we're at a pass mark, but that's actually pretty good given the circumstances. So, Mark, can I ask you, what's your view? Has there been any high points?
Well, I think Hugh has summed it up very well. I think as far as the main, what we might call the mainstream media or the traditional media, as far as that goes, I think it's been a very responsibly reported crisis, and I think while they have conflicting views sometimes. At least the conflicting views haven't been from the real outliers, the loonies. Sometimes there is legitimate medical opinion that might challenge the status quo, and they have covered that quite well. The other thing they've done well is myth-busting. I've seen several mainstream channels and outlets dispelling some of these myths that are circulating on social media about one-stop cures or protections and so on. And they've done an excellent job as a public health information service dispelling these myths.
And this is really your area of expertise, misinformation. Is there an argument that the media is doing a good job with misinformation so far?
Yes, well, I would have to agree with what's been said already. And I think that the media have actually been, when you talk about mainstream media, I think they've actually been pretty quick to get on and debunk some of those hoaxes, a lot of those online hoaxes that were going around early on in the piece, different conspiracy theories. And also there was a lot of racist content as well that the media were pretty quick to say, you know, this isn't even accurate, let alone appropriate to be, you know, consuming these sorts of things on social media. I've just actually hosted a webinar that was open to journalists from across Australia and New Zealand, and I was very impressed by the attitude and the desire for collaboration amongst the journalists, and also the desire to want to keep improving and want to do well and do even better. Because sometimes when you're hosting these webinars, you don't want to sound like you're preaching to people and that you've got all the answers, that sort of thing. But there was, you know, for example, with spin-offs, flatten the curve types of images, data viz and explainers that they've had, and that's been picked up internationally. I think even Obama has tweeted about this sort of thing too. I think we're actually doing, on the whole, a really good job.
Okay, all right. That's fantastic. It's great to see journalists agreeing and trying to work together. So I'm going to try and get some argument going here just to, you know, stick to what we're good at. There's a lot of anxiety out there in the community, as we all know, when we try to get some spaghetti or even worse, some loo paper. Has the coverage been too much at times? Have we gone too far? Hugh, what do you think about this?
Well, I think it's interesting because there's a panic buying approach. We might touch on that a little bit more. But I think, in fact, the louder, more pessimistic voices earlier have proven to be the ones who are accurate. So, you know, I've had the experience of having lived in Hong Kong during in the immediate aftermath of the SARS epidemic, which went through there. I saw how it changed Hong Kong society. My wife lived there through that period as well. So, so when this started, my alerts were very much up. I worked for CNN out of Hong Kong. There was a big expectation that the next global pandemic would be some form of bird flu that would probably come out of southern China. So we talked a lot about this. We had the top experts from the World Health Organization. We were interviewing them, you know, every week or so. We looked at the modeling as to how a city, a sophisticated centralized city like Hong Kong, would deal with the pandemic. And in fact, I learned how low the threshold is for infection and for death rates before you start to see societal breakdown. When teachers stop going to school, nurses and medical health workers stop going down to the hospital because they realize, as we've seen in Italy, that there's not the protection there to save them. So they stop going, which means people go to hospitals. There's no treatment there. So you get a total decline in the police don't turn up for duty, people can't get to the shops, there's looting and a total breakdown in society. These sorts of things were being modeled by the World Health Organization, you know, in the last decade or so in the expectation of a bird flu pandemic. Now, as it turns out, coronavirus, which is similar in many ways to SARS, has now hit us. But my antenna were very much up and alert to this, and I was trying to tell people in the newsroom that this is going to be an enormous story. And it's going to cross borders, and it will be a contagion into the markets. This will change everything. And just that, having had that experience made us more alert to it in terms of how we were reporting it. So I think far from being a case where the media was alarmist, I think the media initially was a little bit casual about it, and that casualness lasted for a little while until we started to see those hockey stick type numbers going up. I think Italy was the thing that really brought it home, and you can see the changed attitude now happening in the United States and the realization that in fact controlled East Asian societies with their command and control mass information systems and really not many individual freedoms or reduced individual freedoms or a willingness to give up individual freedoms, they tend to deal with these crises better than the very individualistic, free, libertarian United States or other parts of the world. And we've seen a bit of that. So we're having to learn how to be a bit more Singapore and a little less laissez-faire, I think. So the media overall, far from being alarmist, I think have... in some ways, they weren't onto it early enough. The toilet paper panic buying was a sign that some people were kind of getting it early, but that, of course, has its negative effects as well.
We'll actually come back to those negative effects in a moment. But, Anne, isn't there also an argument, picking up on what Hugh's saying, that actually you need the media to be producing lots of information to fill data voids that otherwise are filled with fake news?
Yes, absolutely. And it's interesting because SARS was my beat when I was at CNN in Hong Kong as well. And it was the end of 2002. I had actually just given birth to our eldest. And there were these little funny rumours of something happening across the border in Guangdong province. And we were seeing even then that you didn't have smartphones then, but there was just text messaging between people. And people were sending messages like, if you, smoke cigarettes, that sort of thing might help. You know, people just, there was just no information. And I was in touch with World Health Organization daily. We were conducting interviews with the health ministers of Hong Kong. But the tricky thing then was it was just so hard to get good information about what was reliable, what was scientific. Whereas fast forward now, there is a dearth of information there's this influx of information and too much information, and it's trying to find the quality information. And when you've got, as you say, you know, these data voids, because it's the first time that people are starting to search on Google for combinations of words like coronavirus and packages, coronavirus and ice cream, you know, when you think of some of the misinformation and some of the rumours and stories that are out there. So this is a great way for journalists to look at, well, what are people searching about? What do they want to know? And then you can go and write a story and that's going to hold, that says, it is okay to open your package that arrives in the mail. You can keep eating ice cream, these sorts of things. And so it's up to the journalists to produce that information. And I had the exact same thing as well. In early January, I saw there's this funny pneumonia thing happening. I was actually in the airport in Hong Kong on my way back to Australia, and there was a public service announcement, if you have flown from Wuhan, please, you know, check your temperature, that sort of thing. No one was even talking about coronavirus and that sort of thing. And immediately I went, oh, there's something in that, and you know, alerted my colleagues. But it was the same experience as Hugh. It was like, you know, and I said, if this turns out to be something, it's going to be big, it's health, it's going to attract a lot of misinformation. Health misinformation is always vulnerable. If you look at things like vaccines and the anti-vax movements, it's always vulnerable to misinformation because basically people's emotions are heightened. Social media in particular is fantastic at scaring people. So I think still these data voids, there's just no information about it, you know, especially to begin with. So write the stories and fill your own social media pages as well with the content that is going to be easily consumed by your audiences. And I think also we need to do more now with what are our audiences used to? What do they want? Everyone's scrolling through madly on their mobile phones. Everyone's making comments, that sort of thing. But fill it with a lot of visuals, a lot of things that are like memes, but, you know, there's this quality information and that quality content so that people have got something.
If I can just pick up on that last point. Mark, you have written about this in the conversation about the mass of information and how we have to curate our information. One of the things that is suggested by some people is going direct to government official sources. What does that say about the mediation role of journalists, though, if that's what we're doing, if we're going straight to the government source and, you know, going back to that issue of the debate and journalists' role in the debate in society?
Yes, well, you won't get an argument from me with you and Anne, because coming from the journalist's perspective, what Anne was just talking about then, looking at what people are seeking and giving them those answers in practical terms, falls into the category of what's been called constructive journalism or solutions journalism, what I've called mindful journalism. And this is all about giving people something to answer their questions rather than just telling them about conflict and bad news. Now, my concern is not so much that there is news 24/7 and that a lot of that news is bad. That's very much journalism doing what it needs to do. But I come at it from a media literacy angle, and I think that there can be negative effects of people taking in too much negative news in the midst of crisis, and that they really need to take control of their news and social media feeds and know that they can turn off and know that they can turn back on again to the better sources. Now, if that means just at a basic level, knowing that you go to the Commonwealth Government Department of Health for the official information, then that's a great start. But that could be combined, for example, with, you know, two or three times a day dipping into the news hour on television just to see what's happening, to pick up on the latest, because people don't want to lose touch in a rapidly moving situation, but not just sit there all day with 24/7 news going on both on your device and on your television set, particularly when there are children in the house. It's a time where we, you know, one advantage at the moment with people being at home, being self-isolated, is it can be a little bit of time to smell the roses, to engage in more human behaviour with children if they're in the household.
So, Mark, we do need this sort of constructive journalism, this solutions journalism, but what audiences and journalists are part of that audience need to do is take control of their of the way that they're consuming news and make sure that they're not being inundated and maybe using this self-isolation time to not have the news on 24/7, but to be conscious about how they're spending their time. If I can just go pick up on that first point of constructive journalism, of journalism that helps. Hugh, we've seen stories about price gouging and the need to give pensioners a fair chance at the spaghetti aisle, but did media pick up on these issues early enough?
Yeah, look, it's a really... The relationship between the media and information and the public is generally a valuable one, but what tends to happen is that there is human behaviour that responds to it. So people, as it turns out, have broadly speaking been right. It's a terrible thing to say because I don't want to encourage, you know, panic buying and hoarding and so on. But people were recognising that there are likely to be supply chain difficulties, and so various essentials, it's useful to have them. And then people obviously overdid it because that's what people do. And so you're looking for non-perishable food and staples like rice and pasta and so on. I went into my local Woolies last night. There's nothing there. And there was a... someone was picking up some fairly curly bits of ham from the deli counter and saying to the person behind the counter, you know, you're going to get more in. And the woman behind the counter saying, well, we don't know. I don't know. We just turn up and whatever we've got, we sell it. So I think, realistically speaking, there's going to be these supply chain difficulties. Mm-hmm. As for who's to blame for that, it's hard to say. But we plainly, there have been various suggestions, one being that you'll end panic buying if you elevate the price of toilet paper or pasta to four times its normal amount. But what that says is that if you're rich, you can go and have all the toilet paper you want, and if you're poor, then you can't. In Europe, there have been devices where they enforce it, where they say, yeah, your first lot of toilet paper you can have at the normal price, anything more than that's at 10 times the price, and that has had some effect at reducing the panic buying and the hoarding and keeping stuff actually on the shelves. So these other measures are going to have to come in to protect things. But you, in a free society that is individualistic, in Australia, for all its egalitarian self-myths, is a fairly individualistic society, people tend to look after number one, and we see that.
But surely there's a role for media to think about some of these solutions and be part of that debate. So be constructive in terms of the issue of, well, let's think about the pensioners earlier. Like the Woolworths solution is great, but if they had implemented it a week earlier, it would have been much more effective.
Well, certainly our job as the media is to report that there is panic buying. And we certainly report, for example, when the Prime Minister says, stop doing it, it's ridiculous, it's un-Australian, or whatever other phrases he wants to put about it, you can report that. When you have people saying we don't actually have a supply problem, there is enough. If people stop hoarding it, everyone will get their share. So we report those measures. We report people's anxiety, even the reporting of the social media scenes of people literally coming to blows over toilet paper in the supermarkets itself has a kind of shaming effect on people doing the same thing. So those are roles the media can play. The regulations and restrictions and so on need to come in an organised fashion from government and perhaps from the supermarket chains and others. It's the media's job is to report what's going on accurately so the proper decisions can be made. I think that's what I see our job as being.
And can I also pick up the issue of how things are reported? So there was a great photo doing the rounds online. The Daily Mail in the UK front page was many loved ones will die, while the Irish Daily Mail front page was together we can save many lives, you know, same day. Some of this is driven by the leader's rhetoric, as pointed out by Hugh, but some of this is editorial decisions as well.
Yeah, and I think when you have these headlines that are the worst case scenarios, that is absolutely going to stoke fear and panic in audiences. So I think there's, you've got to get the gravity of the situation expressed to the public, but also I think, you know, we're actually very quickly at a point now where people have to consider, you know, the mental health effects of what this is happening. So when you've got headlines that are, you know, 10 times more lethal, catastrophe, coronavirus catastrophe, this sort of thing, you know, no end in sight, I don't actually think that that is necessarily helpful language. It's better to have headlines that are things, you know, what you can do right now about the coronavirus, these types of things. You know, practical tips for coronavirus prevention, how not to panic. I think if we can have, you know, the headlines, the narrative starting to focus on this sort of thing as well, then that is actually more helpful. I think too with the images, and see the thing is you have to realise that people unfortunately are probably not going to read to the very last line of your report, which is, you know, sad because I've worked in digital headquarters and newsrooms and things before and I want people to read my whole article, but we were always mindful of, well, they're probably, you've actually got to write your headline and think, well, this is quite likely the only thing that they will read. This photo is the only thing that they will see. They're not going to read the caption. And you have a look at a lot of the debate that's in social media, community groups and things. A lot of times people start making these comments about things and they obviously haven't read the whole story. They're making their comments just because they've seen a headline or a photo and they're making a lot of assumptions. So when we write our headlines, we have to assume that that might be all that they're going to read. That might be all that they're going to see with the image. I also would challenge, and I did challenge some journalists in the webinar I hosted for First Draft, just when it comes to these images now, and I do agree with you that there's the point that, yes, it's our job to report what's going on, but I think there is a point where perhaps now we need to think, well, let's just think another way about this, because there are social science professors, neural science professors, such as NYU's Jay Van Babel, who's written and tweeted a lot last week about how studies show that if you want to discourage a certain type of behaviour, but then in your message you're showing a picture of people engaging in the type of behaviour, that even if your words say don't do this, it makes some people think that this is normal behaviour. So pictures have an effect in shaping the social norms. So it's, you know, it's a bit of a challenge there. There's no hard and fast answers. But if the media is reporting on panic buying and showing all these pictures of people grabbing toilet paper and panic buying, then you do also get a lot of people thinking, oh, maybe I should be doing this too. So the photo's going to get a lot of clicks. But I think now we need to sort of think, well, what's the most responsible thing to do? And, you know, if we continue, you know, showing people covered in wearing hazmat suits, I think, you know, this is going to trigger alarm or you know, a lot of despair. And if you show a lot of, you know, the empty spaces, this was, you know, used to be a bustling centre point for society. But then if you're starting to report, you know, I'm hearing reports now for Anzac Day of people in self-isolation and there are no marches, well, maybe everyone can stand in their front yards and, you know, look down the street. And we've seen pictures of that, you know, in Italy it's closed off, but people are still singing and leaning out their windows and singing to the street, but still self-isolating. I think if we can have a mix of these, this sort of language as well, and it delves into the, this is the solutions journalism as well. The solutions journalism doesn't have to be, you know, these, you know, necessarily long form types of, you know, journalistic reports and things that are going to take a long time. You can have this attitude as well and be showing reports that are easily digestible and giving really good ideas and tips and solutions for your audience as well now.
That's such a good point. If I can actually just go to a different point though completely, what about the stories that aren't coronavirus stories, which are also coming out at this time? We've had large stories break this week, for instance, the Four Corners expose on the shocking conduct of Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan, or even the Sydney Commute Times blowout revealed by the Sydney Morning Herald. To some extent, these stories have fallen into a black hole. Mark, what do you think? Are we losing our news balance diet?
I think there are times we have to lose our news balance. These are very important stories, and in any other circumstances, they'd be the main topic of news and conversation. But really, with such a health and economic crisis going on, it's our duty to step up and report that, but still pay heed to these other items. Coming back to the earlier issue, I think journalists and the media have made a huge step forward in the area of mental health, both for the journalists themselves through organisations like DART, but also in their reporting to their audiences through programs like Mindframe. And I think it's time to step up in that regard, because I was talking to a medical specialist yesterday who was saying that the next hidden spike is not going to be so much in, you know, after coronavirus tolls, is going to be in the extreme of mental health problems. And we all know what the extreme of mental health problems results in, and he sees those figures escalating. So my concern is what the media can do in the mental health domain to help out. Now, this doesn't mean sunshine news. It might mean running many more of the Are You OK type stories, with psychologists' advice on how to manage your self-isolation, what to do if you've lost your job, how to talk this through with your family. Of course, domestic violence becomes a huge issue in those circumstances when people are at a wit's end or at the lowest points of their lives. Obviously, a big plug here for anyone listening to the Lifeline Beyond Blue phone numbers, which are very easily accessible. But my point is, I think the media has a role, or the mainstream media at least, and in social media through you know, constructive use of that kind of material, to play in shoring up the mental health of our communities as we go through these crises.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Actually, we've touched on the role of social media and individuals' need to actually regulate their own social media behaviour, but also be constructive in the social media that they're getting out there. Can I just ask this, though? Overnight, Facebook acknowledged that their attempts to curb fake news contained what they've called a bug in the anti-spam system, which resulted in pulling down large swathes of coronavirus content. This is always going to be, and that included legitimate news, this is always going to be an issue with social media, relying on algorithms to filter content. Hugh, 10 News now does rely heavily on social media to generate traffic. Does this concern you?
I don't know what you mean by generate traffic. You mean, do we pump out our material through our online 10 daily type of
stuff? You do a great job of actually getting your information out there through the social media feeds and actually, you know, atomizing the pieces so that they can actually be consumed by a large number of people through their social media feeds.
Yeah, so that's the environment we're in, is that you go and try and seek the eyeballs wherever they are, and of course a lot of them are on social media, and you're trying to give them the same you are giving them the same journalistic value through those feeds. So it's one of those kind of curious things that there is a lot of complete rubbish out on social media, but there's plenty of good information out on social media. The Prime Minister has on a couple of occasions very specifically named Twitter as being some sort of problem. I'm active on Twitter. I found that Twitter is fabulous for being able to give you access to direct access to top virologists and epidemiologists all around the world who are talking about the stuff. You get good quality material. It really comes down to choices individuals make and the capacity of people to make choices to filter out what's complete rubbish and what's legitimate information. So social media, I mean, in terms of TEN's output on that, we're trying to go out onto social media, so does the ABC, so does everyone else, I think, who's in this game. And you try to take out the best possible available information that's out there. I think I hear what the fellow panelists are saying there about trying to get out more, gentle information about how things go. I think there's real value in that. I noticed, for example, after the earthquake in Christchurch when I went there, how quickly the New Zealanders, who tend to be a bit ahead of us on these things, in their press conferences would talk about likely effects. They'd have psychologists at the press conferences right at the start of the earthquake saying, here are things that are likely to happen in your household. There's likely to be a temptation to drink more. There's likely to be a temptation, or a risk of higher levels of domestic violence. You need to be aware of this. You need to think about your temper. You need to think about ways to manage your own levels of upset, and all of those messages are good and valuable, and they should be put out there. I'm always a little bit cautious about a suggestion that perhaps the media should sugar the pill of bad news to the degree that it's not fully understood. And I say that in the context of, Alan Jones, who's got a vast audience, radio audience in Sydney, was calling coronavirus the health equivalent of the climate change hoax, that there's nothing to it. So he was telling his audience there's nothing going on. I think at times, like in the initial phase, when there is something going on that is genuinely a thing, it's really important to shake the complacency. It's uncomfortable for people's complacency to be shaken and their expectations to be shaken. But if that's the truth, you've got to shake them. You've got to tell it hard. And then perhaps once everyone's kind of got it and people have got the idea that social isolation is not for others, it's for them as well, that everyone has to manage these things properly, then that's where you say, right, how do we deal with this new reality? But in that initial phase, when you've still got powerful people in the media saying there's nothing to it, ignore it, forget the headlines, don't watch the news, it's rubbish, there's nothing to this stuff, then you absolutely have to be firm in reporting the bad news. This is going to go on for a long time. It's not that there is no end in sight, but it's going to go on for a long time. We're 18 months, according to Tony Fauci, the head of infectious diseases in the United States, from a vaccine. And if this follows the flu pattern of following winters, we're going to have a bad winter. And then the United States and the Northern Hemisphere, including Europe, is going to go into another winter, and they're going to have another season before vaccines come on the market. This is a long-term thing, and it's going to affect jobs. We haven't really talked about the impact on people's work, their jobs, their anxieties over their future. This is going to have profound impacts. The only upside is the capacity for us as a community to recognize what's really important, and that is to join together and to look out for each other and to maybe spend time together in the park. I see gatherings of people in the park near me now just started to sprout in the last couple of days. Where large numbers of people are going down into a public park, and they're not normally there, and they're playing games with their kids, and they're walking around talking to each other at reasonable amounts of distances. They're talking in the streets, out the front of the house at 2 meters distance, and we're getting a sense of community that didn't or certainly enriching the sense of community that we previously might not have had time for. So there are upsides, and we have to accentuate, as Anne said, about the alternative ANZAC suggestion that's being made. There are those things that can be made, and we can talk about those, but the initial stage is, if it's bad, don't sugar it. You've got to tell it's bad till people have got that.
Yeah, and there's still a lot to come, isn't there? So we do need that balance going forward of those, you know, hard economic stories and then what we're doing about them. Everyone, I think that we are coming to the end of our time. Thank you so much for your contributions. This has been so deep a discussion. Can I ask as a final point, one of the silver linings Hugh just pointed to, but does the panel see any other positives in all of this bleakness? Perhaps in terms of the way the media reports science, for example, things that the media are doing really well that we can take forward?
I think the media are absolutely looking to the experts. I think this actually shows what journalism is for. Hugh mentioned Alan Jones. Like, I don't see what he is doing is delivering journalism. I think, you know, he's an opinion journalist. You know, at most he's a commentator, but I think this is a time now for, I'm not suggesting that Hugh was saying he was anything other than that, but I think this is where the media is actually going and dispelling, you know, those myths and those conspiracies and things like that that are being perpetuated by you know, other commentators that have a big platform. And this is where mainstream media can actually go to these experts, to the scientists, and they are doing it. You know, there are amazing resource pages and amazing resources that media companies are putting together. And, you know, journalists, they're the communicators. They're the ones that know how to put all this together. And, you know, there's just a few newer tactics perhaps that we need to be aware of to, you know, get that attention of the audience members. And that's something that's, you know, changing all the time, you know, whether it's, you know, trying to reach people on TikTok or through memes and things like that. But I think, you know, journalists are actually, you know, doing their job, and this actually is a moment for I think it's going to be a watershed moment where we can actually go, you know what, we can trust the media now, and it's our chance to actually do the job, and so that people actually understand what a journalist is, because I think a lot of people don't actually really understand what journalism is.
Well, that's a really positive note. And on that one, I might actually say thanks to our panel. Mark Pearson is Professor of Journalism and Social Media, Griffith Centre for Social and Cultural Research, Griffith University. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Anne Kruger, Acting Co-Director of the Centre for Media Transition at UTS and Bureau Editor, Australia First Draft News. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
And Hugh Rimington, National Affairs Editor at 10 News First. Thank you very much, Hugh.
Great to hear from you all. Thank you.
And thanks for listening to The Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation, and we thank them for their continuing support. Make sure you're subscribed to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics and a few things in between. And can we also ask you to tell your friends about Fourth Estate so we can share this unique insight into our media and body politics? We'll be back with much more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is ForTheStateAU. Thanks to my excellent producer, Anthony Dockrell. My name's Chrysanthi Giotis. Thanks for listening.